Hello and welcome to the Pints and Penalties Scottish Football Podcast. I'm your host Rory West, and on the podcast I'm joined by Cameron Christie.
Hello.
And Harry Tremaine.
Hello everyone.
So back again after another weekend of Scottish Premiership action. I think it's probably fair to say that it wasn't the most exciting of weeks over the four games played at the weekend. A couple of nil-nils, so we'll get right stuck into it, looking at the games first, and we'll kind of cover a few other topics and a couple of questions at the end. So thankfully we're going to start with a few of the games that have some goals involved. And probably one of the most interesting fixtures of the weekend where we're going to start was Ross County 1, Dundee United 2. Thoughts on this result? Was it a surprise that Dundee United won? Without sort of taking the game into account, would you have expected United to take all 3 points in this one?
I personally on a bet had backed the draw, so I thought it was a fairly even game on paper. I thought, as expected, there weren't too many goals, although actually three in a Dundee United game was a bit of a surprise to me. Quite an even playing field for me. And I thought Dundee United, as we'll get on to, looked a little bit sharper at the top end of the pitch, so that'll be a boost for them.
Yeah, I agree with Harry there. I think that from an aspect of going forward, this is the best that Dundee United have looked all season. We were just talking there beforehand, someone you brought up there, Harry, with Bolton. He's a real outlet for Dundee United in the wide areas. It's good that they've managed to get him that little bit further forward from playing the wing back that he's played a couple of times so far. I think that the more game time he gets, he will be a huge player for United. Very, very dangerous in the break. Hugely, hugely quick. Maybe just needs to add that final touch to his game, but a lot of positive signs from him at the weekend.
Stuart Kettlewell said that the game, that Ross County sort of played to the game plan almost perfectly up until the 40th minute when Dundee United would equalise. But before that, we touched on the United equaliser and stuff like that. I would probably agree with him. I thought that County were good in that first 40 minutes, looking like the sort of team that they've been, or they're putting in the sort of performances they have been so far. Again, I was particularly impressed with Harry Payton. Should he have had a penalty with that coming together between him and Mark Connolly?
It's a really tough one, because I've watched it many times in even slowed it down to see just how much contact there was before he goes down. But for me, Connolly steps right across him, so it should be a penalty in my mind, and I think Stuart Kettlewell is well within his rights to be disappointed with that.
He was booked for diving for it, wasn't he?
Yeah,
immediately, yeah. As well. I didn't even think about it.
A harsh one, personally. I can see why it's not being given, but to book him for diving, I think it was a bit much.
I think it's interesting the role he played in this sort of first half, I guess, and particularly in this move that came from this challenge, and he kind of picks the ball up on the right hand side of the attack, almost a right wing for Ross County, and he just slowly moves across the pitch, playing off a couple of 1-2s and stuff like that on his way, and then manages to pick up that spot or that space where he drives into the box. But moving to the Ross County goal, I think this is, I think that one of the before touching on the actual strike itself, which I think is a really good strike, I think Peter Pollitt should actually clear the ball much better. I think his header is quite tame, and it's easy for, gives Garden a heap of time to recycle the ball and into the box. I don't know if you guys thought he was at fault at all.
Yeah, I think we've seen this a little bit with the game so far, is that I've noticed there's been a lot of kind of poor clearances. Just people who just they're just not getting enough on the ball to get rid of it. For instance, there's one that we'll obviously come on to more so later on. This was not so bad. I tend to think that headed ones aren't so bad. It's more when people are trying to clear from the ground or on the half volley where they just don't get enough on it or they don't lift it to bring it off to the halfway line. I'm not probably not going to be too harsh on Pollock here. I don't know if that's just a general soft spot for him, but I wouldn't be too harsh on him.
I think the header's not great, but for me, you should be showing him outside because the angle for the ball back in is much more favourable for Gardine on his right foot. And yeah, I think he could have maybe recovered slightly better from that Pollock. But yeah, I think after that point, it looked a bit odd because the ball's quite central as it's struck by Donaldson, but the goalkeeper is fairly unsighted, so quite a difficult one for him.
Yeah, I think it's quite a difficult goal once the cross is played in, where you'd sort of point the blame to. I think it could potentially just be one of them that you've got to hold your hands up and say that you're not really expecting the centre half to strike a volley that clean and accurately, and it's just a pretty decent goal. Not an awful lot that Dundee United could have actually done to prevent it.
Yeah, I'd agree. And actually, the whole game, if you look at the whole game, for me, Dundee United have come out of their defensive shape one time. I mean, this is obviously the second phase of a set piece. And yeah, like you said, it's kind of out of the blue, your centre half smashing it in from outside the box. But in the second half, they come out of their shape one time and Ross County failed to make them pay. And that's what the entire game hinges on. And that's kind of what I've been alluding to a lot when we speak about Dundee United. They're not going to give up a lot of goals because they are well drilled and they are very disciplined in that defensive shape.
Mm. And then that 40-minute mark hits where Kettlewell seems to think that the County dropped off. Was this a bit of a soft goal for them to lose, do you think? Or am I just being a wee bit too harsh on County?
I think that they're quite slow across the board to react to things, especially when it comes back out to sprawl. He's under relatively little pressure, and the couple of touches and all the ricochets, they all first come to Dundee United players because they're just simply reacting quicker. So I mean, it's a little bit static from Ross County. Obviously, it all comes from just the most basic attacking play of being faster and stronger than your opponent, and that's what Bolton was on Josh Reid, and that's pretty much where the goals come from. It's just come from being able to drop the shoulder and go past someone. But yeah, I just think that Ross County, they'll look really static here, and that's sort of how Bolton's been able to sort of instinctively react to Bolton goal.
Yeah, for me, what you just said there, Christy, when Josh Reid gets beaten there, that seemed to happen from the highlights that I watched quite a lot on that left-hand side of the Ross County defence. I don't think he had his best game, Josh Reid, the youngster. He's looked fairly promising so far, but seemed to be exploited for a little bit of a lack of pace throughout this game. And I know Luke Bolton looks very speedy, but seemed to be a bit of an issue for Ross County, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, he kind of struggled with that against Sherwin Seedorf when he came on in the game against Motherwell. He dealt with Hasty with ease, and then when Seedorf came on, there was a couple of times he just ghosted by him.
Which is unfortunate because Ross County, I mean, it might be the sort of thing with a young player where you need to take him out for a couple of games, but unfortunately their backup is Carl Tremarco, so...
Which is even worse base-wise.
That's a bit of a... it's not the best, but yeah, I think Iacovitti's kind of flat-footed as the ball comes in, and it's kind of caught between two players, and then Peter Pollitt's alert enough to just steal in and whack it home.
Mm. I was actually quite impressed with the composure from Dundee United in the second phase after the ball's cleared, because I think it's Mark Reynolds that receives the ball after the clearance, and he could, you could probably back this up with years of watching him play for Aberdeen, he could easily just lump that ball back into the box where a lot of his players are sort of still at, but he kind of he shows a bit of composure and he plays it out wide. I think it's to Freeman, I think it is, who the ball does make its way to Bolton, where he kind of he causes the main problems for Ross County's defence. But I think if it's just kind of sticking on Bolton, I thought he was again really good for Dundee United. So important to the way they're playing on the counter attack. I think he probably should have got at least one goal in the game. I guess, as I think you said last week, Christy, we're not really sure where he's been sort of playing in his previous spells. I think you said he was a Luton, was that right?
Luton last year, aye.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if he's been playing as this wing back position or more advanced. Still a young guy, so I guess finishing off one-on-one chances is something he'll probably get to learn a wee bit more, but I think he's such a dangerous outlet for United.
I thought he benefited as well. I thought he benefited from the fact that Dundee United were kind of forced to play Spurla on the left-hand side, who I don't think is quite as forward-thinking as Jamie Robson is. Just kind of allowed him the licence to be a little bit higher throughout the game. Which I think does suit his game better, as we've kind of noted before.
Well, you just need to look at it there. The alarm bells were kind of ringing for Ross County prior to the goal, because there was another time where Bolton had managed to get in behind Reid, and that happened every time in the game. I liked how noticed, especially in the second half, and I think those chances Rory's talking about there, United kind of squeezed the game down the left hand side to give Bolton so much space on the right, and expose him up against Reid, allowing it to be that one-on-one battle that Bolton was winning majority of the time. I thought that, you just talk about Ross County's game plan. I mean, to me, that looked like the Dundee United game plan, and obviously they didn't get the goal from it from Bolton, but it absolutely worked because they were a constant threat down that side the whole game. And I mean, from what we've seen in the highlights, obviously might not have been the whole story, but it would have just been a goal would have been all that was needed to sort of cap off a really strong performance from Bolton.
Something that we've been quite impressed so far with Dundee United is their ability to kind of soak up pressure. I thought that pressure that Ross County put on them was a wee bit more intense once Lee Irwin came on. I was really impressed with him. I think we talked about him after Ross County's win over Hamilton, I think it was, when they played like the front three of him, Stewart and Mackay. I think this case, the link play between Irwin, Stewart and Payton was really impressive. I think there's a couple of chances that Irwin creates for Stewart where he probably should score. I'm wondering whether starting Irwin could be something that Kettle will rethink in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Well, I was just gonna say the chance that I was referencing earlier is when Irwin picks up the ball and Reynolds gets sucked out, has a little nibble, doesn't quite get it, so he's out of position, and then Connolly gets drawn to the ball. And it's a really nice slipped pass from Irwin into Stewart. And for me, that has to be a goal from him there. And that was the only time I saw Dundee United properly bent out of shape. And Ross County didn't quite have the clinicality to take advantage of it.
Yeah, definitely. I think when you see about Irwin, I can't remember if it was that the chance you're speaking of or another one. There was a time where he is out on that left and he just turns two United defenders inside out and gets his ball across. He definitely looked at a much bigger threat coming on than what Ross County did on the park at the time. But w- w- with Stuart, I think we're seeing that this is a player who probably isn't yet the sort of the finished article, and there's kind of a reason that he's kind of still where he is. We obviously rate him pretty highly here, but at the same time, you look at a couple of those chances that he's had, obviously the one that Ari's talking about where he slips it past the post, and then there's one in the first half where he kind of he puts it over the bar. A player who's a little bit further on in his development probably scores at least one of them. So he's still got a little bit to go, but you'd imagine possibly the next step in his career could hopefully take him to that next level that he seems to be capable of, but he's just not quite there yet.
Yeah, I thought this was a game that, yeah, as you said, it's almost a learning curve for him. I think he's at a couple of games now where he's had a few good chances in really dangerous positions. There was even one in the Hamilton game as well, where he hit the post. He's getting in decent positions, but I don't know whether he's just maybe getting his body positions wrong or something like that. But United do get their winner through and. Again, it's Nicky Clark making me eat my words. I don't think I made a prediction, but I was pretty harsh on him in the season preview, and he's already come up with the goods twice now for Dundee United. But it's a really nice goal. I really like the quick feet from Logan Chalmers and the early stages of the move. And United do really well to draw a lot of the Ross County defenders into sort of a narrow space inside their penalty area, which opens up the room for Nicky Clark to finish off the pass that's made by Cammy Smith, who I actually forgot was at Dundee United, to be honest. But yeah, I thought this was a really good goal.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. I think the quick feed from Chalmers is superb. It's exactly what you want to see from one of the Dundee United players in that attacking area. We obviously talked a lot about the running ability of the likes of Bolton, but here the close control and the ability to draw out opponents, and it's the fact that they were able to be incisive, just two passes, bang bang, goal. That's a real problem, and it shows that they are able to break down difficult opponents with just basic passing and moving. I mean, that's the passing and moving, the tempo, something like John Collins. But for me, a really impressive goal, and something that you probably wouldn't have labelled with Nicky Clark, but it's a very, very composed finish back across the goalkeeper.
Yeah, and also positive for Dundee United that they can bring a guy like Cammy Smith off the bench and he can impact the game. That's a really well-weighted pass to Nicky Clark. Puts him in to the best possible position he could be to score. And yeah, he makes no mistake, so unlucky, Rory. You've got that one wrong, I think.
Yeah, I think I have. I'll hold my hands up. obviously, first defeat of the season for Ross County. And again, kind of off the back of potentially a disappointing result against Kilmarnock, where they were originally leading, but fair play, they did come back in that game. Is there any signs for them to begin to worry of form dropping off, or is this going to happen to them every so often? They might get caught on the break.
Yeah, I think he's still trying to find out what his best team is. It's changed a lot, with the exception obviously the back four and the goalkeeper. They've been a solid pick. He's changed the system and changed the players that are in it. Going forward, I think that Ian Vigers and Ross Stewart are the only two to have started every game. He's obviously got the options of Draper, Payton, Gardine, Mackay, Irwin, Mullen, Tilson, Regan Charles-Cook, and Stephen Kelly to throw into the mix as well. So I think he's still trying to find the right blend of all of them, and he's given sort of people an opportunity to get their name out there to show that they should be the player starting. So I don't think I wouldn't be worried. I don't think there's any warning signs here at all. I just think that the sooner he's going to find this the right 11 to pick, the better for Ross County.
Yeah, I think actually, if you look at Ross County's sum total from the four games they've played, it's a much better start than I would have probably suspected at the start of the season. I think that there have been promising signs from them going forward, and they have been better defensively. I think this game was super competitive, and Dundee United have shown themselves to be no mugs. Like I've said, they're going to be involved in a lot of tight games this season, and this one, unlike what Brian Rice said about Hamilton's game last week, could have probably gone either way. Like we said, they did have some good chances, but yeah, I think they're going to be on the end of a couple of these. I think, like I said, Josh Reid is going to have a lot of experiences this season where he's going to need to take a lesson from them, and it'll be interesting to see if that lack of pace that seems to have been exploited in this game goes into Kettlewell's thinking for their upcoming games, whether or not he needs someone who can provide him a little bit more cover.
And Dundee United, you could probably say the same about them, that you wouldn't have really expected them to have as many points as they have so far. Or maybe not expected, but they were just such a difficult team to call with a new manager and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I probably wouldn't have expected them to come out of the first four games with as many points as they have.
Yeah, they'll both be happy with their current points return at the minute. So I would say, especially Dundee United on paper, they probably had a slightly trickier start compared to Ross County. But at the same time, you look at the results, and it's not also every game they've been involved. Like you say, every game they've been involved with has been competitive. None of them have been blown away. Even in sort of narrow defeats, it's not also they've been dominated or anything. Mm. Which I think is probably is going to be the way things go. We're looking at a lot of the games between these sides at the minute. Obviously, we're talking about St Mirren, Kilmarnock, St Johnstone, Livingston, Ross County, Dundee United, that sort of teams. All the games between them at the minute have been so tight, just the odd goal in it. And I think that's the way it's going to go this season. Obviously, it sounds cliched, but you know, if there are going to be games that could go either way, if someone wins narrowly, fair enough. If there's a draw, fair enough. If the other team wins narrowly, fair enough. I can't see many droppings, with the possible exception of the obvious.
Yeah, well, just to kind of cap off the point, I mean, if you're looking at Ross County and Dundee United, who certainly myself, I didn't think they were going to have great seasons, but if you're looking at them after four games, they're sitting on 7 points apiece, and probably both would make the case that they should have more points than that. Dundee United, I thought, were unlucky in their first game against St Johnstone, and Ross County maybe a little bit unlucky against Kilmarnock. So I think both will be pretty delighted with their start, to be honest.
Mm. You mentioned Kilmarnock there. We'll move on to their game at the weekend against St Johnstone. And I think this is one where they'll be massively disappointed. They've not taken anything from the game, losing 2-1 at home, even though they were 1-0 up in the game. Just kind of start the things off. I know we're still early in his spell as the number one goalkeeper at Kilmarnock, but when the worries set in about Danny Rogers, there's I think it's earlier on in the game, and he goes for an easy high ball, and he completely drops it. And I don't think there was a save towards the end. He does react quite well. It was from a free kick, but still doesn't look too convincing. And then personally, I don't think he's completely shy of the blame for the winner for St Johnstone. Would you have any worries about him?
I would have some worries, and I think that, to be fair, I mean, obviously, his kind of lack of game time at this level probably plays into that. But for me, with goalkeepers, you've got to be somewhat patient. I think the goal they conceded against Celtic was very much his fault. But I think that you've got to persist to a certain degree with goalkeepers, and I think he needs to be given a little bit more time before Alex Dyer makes any rash decisions in terms of, you know, taking him out or anything like that. But yeah, it's a little bit of a concerning start.
Well, yeah, he's likely got till November time, I think, as the number one, unless they move to bring anyone else in, or God forbid, have to play Colin Doyle. So he does have a bit of time to find some form, find some confidence. What I will say is you've obviously identified there with the inability to come out and deal with the cross. I think that is possibly down to a lack of height. I think he's under 6 foot, and for this level, that is very small for a goalkeeper. Even looking at some of the professional clubs when they're sort of advertising that they're looking at goalkeepers, and the profile is, even at 15, 16 year old, they're looking for goalkeepers that are about 6 foot tall at that age. And, you know, Danny Rogers is what, in his mid-20s now, and he's obviously not going to get any bigger. So I do think he lacks that imposing figure that you look for in a goalkeeper. I mean, you could look to Alan McGregor and say he's not that big, but Alan McGregor is significantly better than Danny Rogers in his positioning and his general decision making. There's not many times you see Alan McGregor who will come out for a ball and totally miss it, or come out for a ball and the attacker has won it before him. His general decision making is significantly better, and that's why he gets away with being a little bit smaller.
In terms of the game itself, I think looking through some of the incidents, I think Alan Powers actually, well, obviously Killie get a red card later on in the game, but I think he's quite lucky to avoid a red card in this game. He gives away a fumble, while it's still 0-0, for a really late tackle on Hendry, and I don't know if this is his first foul in the game, obviously just going off of the highlights, but I just think that's really late and reckless. And I don't really like this sort of argument, but it's in a dangerous area of the pitch. And he then goes and gets a yellow card later on in the game for diving. I don't know if any of you picked up on that one at all, but if so, would you have thought that he was lucky to escape a yellow card for that tackle?
I just said, yeah, he's definitely lucky to escape a yellow. I thought initially you were making the case that he's maybe getting a red for that. I wouldn't have said straight red, but yeah, definitely a booking for me. And in the grand scheme of things, I think he is quite lucky to be on the pitch at the end of the game.
Yeah, same here, but that's now he's maybe booked in all the games this season, which is a worry because you just cannot go on like that. You know, you're just going to be suspended all the time. What is it, six yellows for a one game ban, and he's sort of heading that way by the end of the month. It's a little worrying that he's kind of spending significant parts of the game sort of walking on a tightrope. This one's kind of a daft one that obviously we were saying there he should be booked prior to that, but obviously this is a daft booking for yellow, but he does have a tendency to go in for challenges fairly strongly, and also kind of ones that you think, just like that goal, you're not going to win that. There's no point in sort of diving in here and picking up a booking, and obviously having, like I say, having to walk that tightrope for a good chunk of the game.
Killie did take the lead, as we mentioned, through Aaron Tshibola. Who's at fault for this goal? Is it all the blame down on Rooney, or does Parrish deserve a little chunk of the blame?
Well, I think that Parrish is less to blame than even I think McNamara gets a little bit of the blame by the commentary, and I think in one sense he needs to be giving Rooney a shout because I think that Sean Rooney's completely unaware that Chris Burke, I think it's Chris Burke, Pinnock's kind of stealing in behind him, but he seems to have no idea about that, and someone needs to be giving him a shout. But having said that, I was saying this to you beforehand, Rory, but Sean Rooney is pointing at the ball and expecting Parrish to come out for a bread and butter ball down the middle that's swinging away from the goalkeeper. In my opinion, he has to just deal with that himself. I mean, obviously, he could have done with the benefit of a shout, but he definitely could have made that ball. So for me, Rooney's mostly at fault.
Pretty much the same. But I think the thing for me is it comes over because Kibam has pinned Gordon, unable for him to win the ball in the air. He's done a great job in holding him off, because, I mean, really, you look at this, it's a bog standard long ball over the top. There's nothing special about this, and yeah, I think it's just that there's a mix of blame between Rooney, the goalkeeper, and possibly McNamara, because I think most for Rooney, because even though you think, oh, he doesn't know that he's there, he should know he's there. Pinnock in coming in from the wide area, Rooney should know that he's there and he should deal with it, but he just doesn't. It's kind of a switch off. It's a almost inexcusable mistake for someone who, you know, this is his first start of the season, so it was a big opportunity for him, and doesn't cover himself in massive glory.
Literally,
I just like the thing as well. But sorry, Rory, I was just going to say, I think Kilmarnock prior to this had all of the game in terms of chances, and possibly should have been further ahead by this point. It has to be said, I really was not impressed by St Johnstone. Obviously, we'll get on to the incident that totally changed the game in my mind, but up until that point, I think Kabamba has two decent chances. Chris Burke has a good effort saved by Parrish. I think Kilmarnock, obviously this goal kind of comes out of nothing, but we're unlucky to not have scored before that.
Well, I was going to kind of ask that after we'd rounded up with the game itself, but I guess we can just go to it now. I think Killy will massively regret not taking those chances. They should have easily come out of this game with 3 points, in my opinion. And that's also taken into account, I think the St. Johnstone goals are pretty soft goals to lose as well. I don't know how much of blame you can put that down to the manager, or just... I don't think the thing on Sports Scene, they were giving Elliot Parrish a fair bit of praise for his saves. I don't think too many of them are outstanding saves. I think they're ones you'd expect your goalkeeper to make.
The one from Burke's a decent save, but I think aside from that, yeah, I'd agree. They're kind of, you'd expect them to be making them.
Yeah,
I find that is a sort of a general theme now, is that a goalkeeper makes a decent number of saves, and it was like, oh, what a game the keeper's had. But you look at a lot of those saves, and they are fairly bog standard saves that, as a percentage, you would think a goalkeeper should save. A lot of them sort of 95 to 97% of the time. I think back to some of the last couple of Manchester United Europa League games. There's not that, you know, there's maybe one or two saves between the two goalkeepers that you think, wow, that is a really good save. A lot of them are saves that you expect the goalkeeper to make. So we're getting a wee bit lost in saying that, like, a goalkeeper's made a couple of 10 saves, but nine of them, if they're like that, and it's a massive, massive mistake.
Yeah. As I said, I think they'll massively regret that, and I don't think you can put an awful lot of blame down to Alex Dyer. Actually, when you come to think of it, I know it's a bit cliched, but sometimes that happens. Those games, you just can't take your chances, and you have to remember that. Eamon Brophy didn't start the game. They're a key striker. So I guess it's all still a learning curve in a way. It's still Alex Dow's first full-time managerial job. But yeah, I was waiting to touch on after the goal. It's literally the last thing you want to happen. You go 1-0 up and then 2 minutes later you're down to 10 men. And I don't think there's any complaints for Ross Mullen's red card either. It's just
no. It's a rubbish challenge.
As I said, absolutely no complaints. No, he's completely lost control. Straight red. See you later, Ross. I think Haz, you wanted to touch on Aaron McGowan's defending for the St Johnstone equaliser.
First and foremost, I just think that Ross Mullen challenge is just. I can't understand what goes through his head to be making that. Like you said, I mean, they've just gone up 1-0 2 minutes before that. You just want to keep it tight for 5 minutes. Just make sure you're kind of settled down back into the kind of basics again. But yeah, that's terrible. And then we kind of spoke about Aaron McGowan earlier in the season. We sort of expected him to start in that right back position for Killie at the start of the season, and unfortunately for him, this piece of defending for St Johnstone's equaliser will not help him in that vein going forward, because first of all, the touch as it comes through, you can maybe forgive because he has two bites at clearing this because he sees it late. But the second, just put out for a corner. You're down to 10 men and you're defending a one goal lead. I have no idea what he's doing there.
And it's also worth remembering that there is only, I think, 5 minutes left at that point. So they're getting close to seeing out that game with 10 men and their 1-0 lead. Yeah, as you say, I don't think he's done himself any favours with that one. And they go and blow it. I don't know where what portion of the blame I'm putting to either side here. Is that Stuart Finlay's pass too short for Rodgers? I think for sure you can see in the highlights that Rodgers is just, he's pretty much standing still. He's on his heels to anticipate that ball. I think if you look at the Finlay's body shape when he kind of turns back towards his own goal, it's fairly obvious he's thinking about passing it back to him, and I don't think that Rodgers anticipates it well enough.
I would agree, Rory, with that, but again, this is the 94th minute. You're 1-1. Okay, you probably should have won the game, but you've already lost a very cheap goal. You should probably just take your point and leave. For me, Stuart Finlay should just boot that into row Z, as it were. I don't know why he's taking the risk. And yeah, I think Rodgers is kind of randomly backpedaling at the point when Finlay goes to pass the ball. But to be fair, credit to Michael O'Halloran for just continuing to sprint from about the halfway line and the circle at the halfway line. He's kind of anticipated it from there. He's read the play, so fair play to him. He's stolen a victory for St Johnstone there.
Yeah, I think on both goals are highly avoidable. McGowan, I also think you've probably got time to let that run across him and then, you know, hook one up the line. He also just goes for it. He goes for it with totally the wrong foot as well. I mean, it's just a generally bizarre phase of play from him. Someone who we were like, well, why is he not playing? And you kind of look at this and you think, well, is that why? Mullen's been given the chance. Really, really disappointing. And this one, and the second goal there, I mean, Danny Rodgers is probably too deep for a start, but I think Harry said there, I mean, this is another one, it's a nothing ball, just put it in the stand. But even then, I'm not sure that Danny Rodgers is massive about pedding. He's so deep. I know obviously the ball's come over the top, but I mean, you're playing percentages, and why are you so deep? You know, you find, well, you should be dealing, you know, Stuart Finlay's going to deal with that, but either stick it in the stand. I mean, yes, Finlay's body positions, you could say that Rodgers should anticipate, but Finlay doesn't actually ever look over to see what's there. He almost instinctively plays it back, but it's fantastic pace from O'Halloran and great composure to finish.
Yeah. I think it was fair to say, 94th minute, there's probably not too much left to go. You probably should just lump that out of the park. But it'd be massive relief for Callum Davidson getting his first win as St Johnstone manager. As we mentioned on the last podcast, covering the midweek games, took a bit of a spanking against Rangers. Kind of just needed to take their medicine with that one almost. I don't think they were massively impressive in this game, but they'll take the 3 points without a doubt.
I've not been super complimentary about St Johnstone, but this win will definitely take some of the pressure off of Callum Davidson and some of the players. And to be fair to them, in contrast to the game against Rangers, they did at least look a little bit sharper. The likes of Hendry and things like that had a little bit more pep in their step, so at least they're moving in the right direction. And I think, you know, obviously 4 points on the board after 3 games is not too bad for St Johnstone.
I think if you're looking to for Has to be any more complimentary, I don't think we're going to get it as we move on to Hamilton 0, St Mirren 1. What criticism do you have for Brian Rice this week?
Not as much, to be fair. I mean, a lot of it comes down to the fact that they had their best player back in the team. He says he felt aggrieved and very concerned. I can understand why. I think in the second half, to be fair to him, I think he's got it right that they did play slightly better, created a few chances. But for me, Jim Goodwin kind of played into their hands, changed up the formation to accommodate two forwards, and I don't think it suited St Mirren in this game.
No, I think that in terms of the first half, I thought that I'd potentially disagree. I thought that the front two were quite dangerous, but I'm not sure how much I'm putting that down to the forwards play themselves or just how poor Hamilton were defensively and how easy it was for them to create chances. I thought that St Mirren created plenty in the first half anyway, but it's just such a lack of a clinical spark in that team. I guess it's going to come, we know that Obika can score goals. I think we got 12 last season, and when you're looking at a club down that sort of end of the league, that's quite valuable to have a player who can score that many. But yeah, maybe against a better team, you're not going to be afforded that sort of that comfort of not being able to take those chances.
Yeah, St Johnstone been solidly defensively, but they definitely need to be more clinical going forward. They had decent chances. I think a couple of them had fallen to Junior Marais, had fallen to Beaker. They might have had a second one. I find Marais quite a rash finisher. But you say there about Obika with the goals that you say he got 12 last year, but I think he had quite a slow start because he along with many others were kind of coming into the season kind of mid August time, not having really had a pre season because of sort of the disaster that the St Mirren had had last summer with Oran Kearney and then getting Jim Goodwin in. So it took a lot of those players a wee bit of time to get up to speed. But once they got up to speed, Obika did always sort of look a threat and definitely look like St Mirren's best chance in scoring goals. So I think it'll be interesting to see if he can better that goal tally, because there doesn't look like too many more reliable sources of goals in that St Mirren team.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I mean, I agree with you about Marais. I don't think his, especially in this game, his finishing doesn't seem to be that composed. But yeah, in terms of my point about how they played the two forwards and it didn't really suit St Mirren, in the second half, as is kind of natural for a team like St Mirren, they started to drop a little bit deeper, obviously away from home. And also I was a little bit perplexed that St Mirren, I think they only made one substitute in the entire game. Yeah, Dermouche coming on for McAllister. So I thought that was a little bit odd, that he didn't maybe change it and take on a midfielder later in the game, when Hamilton were a little bit in the ascendancy. So that was a little bit of an odd one for me.
I think it's quite evident from this game anyway, and I know he didn't look his sharpest, but Hamilton are going to rely on David Templeton so much as their sort of main attacking source. He did kind of look to make things happen a wee bit more in the second half, and if you compare that to sort of previous games where they've just, I mean, just kind of think back to the Ross County game, we were talking about that, like that high final sort of chunk of highlights when they're looking to sort of create something and you have one header that goes straight in the keeper's arms. I think he created a few decent chances for them, but it's just, I mean, you talk about St Mirren lacking a clinical edge, like Hamilton just have nothing.
I was just going to say, I mean, Moyo won a few flick-ons, things like that, did a decent shift for them, but there's one chance in particular where there's a cutback, and it looks like he's dummied the ball for someone behind him, but no, he's taken a swipe, completely missed the ball, and unintentionally it goes through to, I think, Callahan, who's running in behind him.
Mm.
Yeah, all that Hamilton chances fell to the wrong players. I mean, you really want your best chances falling to the likes of Ross Callahan. I know for a fact that I don't. But you said there earlier that Templeton, he's everything. The positive that Hamilton did in that second half was coming through him, and that's because he moved back inside. Because I don't think you really think he's someone who wants to do that defensive dirty work. You give him that free role. You drop one of your strikers and give him that sort of free role in between the two if you want someone to create something. And it's clear that, again, he looks a bit on the heavy side, so he's not going to do too much tracking back in the midfield. But you're kind of used to that because you've been playing 4-4-2 since the season began. So you know quite well that that's your sort of limit. But for me, I'd much rather have Templeton playing off of, let's say, Moyo than some of the guff really that they've had up there with him. Like, I mean, you just need to look at Ogunpo when he came on at Parkhead. All he wanted to do was get sent off, really. So if they want to create chances, then it needs to be with Templeton playing through the middle.
So that was, yes, I think it's again fair to say that St Mirren defended pretty well. There was a few chances, but I wouldn't say there was that. I think barring maybe one free kick or shot from a free kick in the first half, Jack Anik had a save that was really strenuous at all. But that's two wins from three games for them now. I think if you're looking at the games they've won so far, you'd maybe be a wee bit surprised with the Livy one, but given the form since they started the season, maybe not. But I think they'll be relatively pleased with their start. I don't think that you were expecting St Mirren to be winning games by a considerable number of goals, but I don't think, I think Jim Goodwin will be fairly pleased with what he's seen so far.
Yeah, if you're talking about, you know, their long-term goals, the two games that they have won are the games that they need to be winning against a team like Livingston, and obviously a game against Hamilton at the current moment is definitely favourable to them. And on the flip side, Hamilton and Brian Rice can kind of be a little bit more optimistic about the second half performance, but ultimately, in previous seasons, these are the sorts of games, especially at home, that Hamilton have won traditionally that kind of pull them out of trouble. And obviously they've scored one goal this season, which was a fairly heavy deflection and ended up being completely meaningless. So it's a bit of an issue for them.
They looked a little bit better going forward in the second half, obviously with Templeton going through the middle. But even then, none of those chances, what you would have said, were great, clear-cut goal-scoring chances. So I just, and the fact that, you know, I mean, they've played once and Hamilton are still bottom.
Yeah, that Aberdeen only playing once is something we'll touch on after the games, but unfortunately that's it for the goals for the rest of the games. A 2-0 nils to follow. One that was the Saturday night game, Hibs at home to Motherwell. Didn't catch it. Was too busy with a finger injury, as you know. I won't post the picture on our Twitter account because it's fairly gruesome. Well, it's not that gruesome. It could have been much worse. But anyway, much to take from this game?
No.
Has.
I thought that Motherwell were a little bit better than they have been in previous games, and probably are unlucky not to have taken the 3 points. I'm inclined to agree with Stephen Robinson about the disallowed goal. I think that it should have stood.
Well, I guess that's the main sort of talking point coming from this game. You said there, obviously, Has, you think it should have been a goal. Christy, what was your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I kind of think the same as well. But at the same time, if Seedorf isn't there, I don't think that Hamlin makes the move to try and get in front of the ball. And then if Hamlin doesn't make the move, then Marciano probably saves the shot. So I can see the thinking behind both. It's one of them that I'm absolutely furious if it's gone against my team. But at the same time, I'm probably a bit annoyed if the opposition have scored that goal. As I know, it's a lot of fence setting. A bit cliched, but it is one of them that I can see why they've given offside, but I do think it's pretty harsh.
The only element I don't like about it is Stephen Robinson calling for VAR in Scotland.
Oh, come on, Steve.
Yeah, I mean,
would that make the difference?
No, because that's purely subjective. Because you, Christy, you've got the opinion that Hanlon wouldn't make the motion if Seedorf isn't there. But I actually disagree with that. I think he would make the motion anyway, because I think he believes he can get a block on the shot regardless. It's a purely subjective decision. And you're going to have people unhappy on either side. I can obviously see both sides of the argument, but for me, it should have stood.
That's his second disallowed goal of the season, so hopefully for him it's third time lucky.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I was going to touch on in the goal. I think, regardless whether Seedorf's involved or not, I think it's a pretty decent... I know it is quite down the middle of the goal, but I think it's quite a decent strike from Jordan White. And I think the other disallowed goal against... it was Dundee United, wasn't it? That was a really good header as well. So he is quite unlucky with these decisions that have gone against him in a way. Of I think the Dundee United one was a foul, so I guess not as unlucky, but there's a bit of promise there from him.
Yeah, I think like the best sort of number nine through the middle striker so far this season for Motherwell. Tony Watt isn't really going to score you many goals, and Chris Long, he looks like he's kind of just re-signed for Motherwell because there was nothing else on the table for him, because obviously he sort of disappeared and came back again. And I also hate the fact that Chris Long is wearing number 99. Just go away with that.
For me, Jordan White has been, it's especially in this game, stood out to me for Motherwell, and in the sense that Motherwell have kind of changed a little bit to accommodate him in a starting role alongside Long. Which, again, it just goes to show that Stephen Robinson is not afraid to change when needs must. And, yeah, I think they were unlucky against what was, up until this point, a really red-hot Hibs side. They probably looked the better side for me.
Another positive, I guess, from Motherwell's point of view is I thought David Turnbull was looking pretty dangerous. His cross is the source for the disallowed goal, and he also puts one on a plate for Lang in the second half, and I think Lang could potentially gamble a wee bit more. I'm not sure if it's just he was trying hard to time his run and make sure he wasn't offside, but. I think, I thought David Turnbull was picking up some dangerous positions and some pockets of space that it's maybe looking more like the David Turnbull we knew before his injury. In terms of Hibs, though, I think this was coming, to be honest. If you look towards this sort of XG in the previous games, it was they were massively overperforming. They were never sort of for example against Dun United it was 0.81, and then against Livingston 2.66, and against Kilmarnock it was 0.86. So they were really overperforming in terms of that. So I think a result like this was probably coming for Hibs.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree. I think there's going to be games where they come up against systems that their system is not suited. And I mean, I think we kind of saw that against Dundee United to some extent. Was a game of few chances, and they just happened to take one on the night. This was a similar type of game, in my opinion. And yeah, I think they're not going to be quite as free scoring as maybe that Livingston game suggested.
Is that a worry?
Maybe, but the other thing is, in these tight games, they do have, like I said, they do have the firepower. They've got players who will take the chances. And I think, to be fair, if you compare this version of Hibs to the one you had last season, they're a lot more dangerous.
I'd worry about the midfield too. For me, that you're not going to get enough out of Newell and Gogic as a two. For me with Hibs, you have to have some sort of creativity through the middle. You have to have Scott Allen in it. You've got to sort of accommodate him and your team. Whether or not that's to go again back to a 3-5-2, or if it's to go with a 4-3-3 with. Obviously Boyle on the right, and Nisbet or Doige, one of them through the middle, one off the left. The other issue I have with Hibs playing the back four is from an offensive point of view, you get nowhere near enough for the level that Hibs should be looking for. You get nowhere near enough going forward at Paul McGinn. I think his role is absolutely best as that right-sided centre-back for back three, which I think kind of possibly suits Hibs the most. Only issues, obviously, you maybe have Martin Boyle a little further back, but the midfield two of Newell and Gogic can't go on too much longer. And when you think about the other players that they can play in there, likes of Allen and Malin, they don't suit a midfield two either. So I think the Jack Ross is going to have to revert to a midfield three. And I think we saw on the weekend, when you come up against a good midfield, like Motherwell have with capable runners in Campbell and O'Hara, they will begin to sort of run over the top of you.
I think as well, a problem that Hibs have is that perhaps Jack Ross feels obliged to kind of shoehorn both Nisbet and Doige into the team. And I'm not necessarily sure. I mean, again, it kind of goes to what you're saying, Christy, but if you were to take one of those players out of the side and put in a more creative midfielder like Scott Allen, you'd probably see an improvement there.
I think you can. Honestly, I think there is a way that you can fit all three in. You either need to play one off the left, or you revert to 3-5-2 and play Boyle as your wing back.
Yeah, it just depends on whether he's willing, or he's sort of willing to sacrifice some elements of one of those two in order to benefit the team, which he should be as manager, but you know what I mean.
For me, as a midfield two, you can't play too much through the middle with someone who is a fairly limited player like Gogic. You either need to go more direct and longer, or you need to solely rely on your wide players. And I'm not 100% sure you can rely regularly on someone like Darryl Horgan.
We'll move on to the Sunday game now, which was also a 0-0. Livingston 0, Rangers 0, that is. What went wrong for Rangers in this game? Because they absolutely dominated. They had 23 shots, only 2 on target, and 10 of them were blocked. 78% possession with an 84% pass accuracy. And they also had 70% of their shots from central areas, which usually is a dangerous area at the pitch. So what was the issue? What was the difference between this game and the previous three?
Well,
the better.
Yeah,
much more difficult.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, they came up against a team who, I mean, it is fair to say that their main objective in the game was to not get beat. But having said that, playing a flat back five, it sounds very defensive, and it is, but you need to be fully committed to those positions and those roles. And to be fair to Livingston, it was a really well-disciplined performance at the back. Obviously, we've kind of highlighted the movement that Rangers have shown this season, and it's only by virtue of how well Livingston defended that they were able to stop Rangers for the most part. And also, you're mixed in with some really big chances that Rangers did squander. The one that sticks out to me is Kent. He's got time to set the ball out and take the shot from the edge of the box towards the end of the game. I think it's a mix of both, but mostly credit to Livingston for defending magnificently.
Yeah, I think. Do you reckon any you could touch on the Rebo injury affecting Rangers at all? Was he a big loss in this game, or would it have just been the same even if he was on the pitch?
I think he is a big loss in the game. You know, we've identified the last couple of weeks that he seems to be the one who's playing those defence splitting passes out of the sort of the forward thinking Rangers players. Look back, obviously, the one he plays through for Barisic in a game against St Mirren, and he's the one who manages to break the lines in one of the games against St Johnstone. So they absolutely are missing him, and our field, he just isn't a capable replacement for me anymore. I think, again, you take one of those players out and it kind of breaks the system a little bit. That's maybe why Gerrard has largely trusted a group of what is 13 players, which is the front six that they've consistently picked, swapping out Hollander and Balogun, and obviously the two goalkeepers. I mean, that no one else is starting a game domestically. I know Brandon Barker somehow managed to get a start against Leverkusen, but yeah, you did lose. I thought you lost the vision of Aribo with bringing in someone who is a bit more of a runs about type player than Scott Arfield.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I don't think that our field offers nearly the same creative output for Rangers. And the other part of it is I don't see him, you know, floating about from side to side of the pitch, which Aribo does. I mean, if you look at Aribo's heat maps, I'd imagine, because having watched him play, he's constantly on the move. He always crops up in different positions, and I don't think that our field's got the same kind of work rate, which you can kind of understand.
In terms of Livingston, surely this is a further step in the right direction for them. You can hark back to the comment from Gary Holt that they need to sort of get back to basics and what made them so good the previous seasons. And this was kind of it, wasn't it? They were pretty, basic. Didn't do an awful lot going forward, but they'll more than happily take their point.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fundamental defensive performance. And I did see some criticism of them, mostly by Rangers fans. Because
and Tom English.
Yeah. And I think that, the style of play in this particular game wasn't great to watch aesthetically in the classic sense, but this is the best sort of result you could have really hoped for realistically for Livingston against a Rangers team who, I mean, they've won three on the bounce. They look very dangerous going forward. And Livingston, I mean, they only had a point on the board, so I don't see why they wouldn't set up in this manner. And fair play to them because they've pulled it off. And I mean, the likes of St Mirren couldn't pull it off. St Johnstone couldn't pull it off. So fair play to them.
We kind of asked the question, or made the point rather, in the previous podcast last week about a mentality for Rangers that they've got to just keep on winning. There was all that talk during the week, or they could be, it was up to 11 points clear of Celtic by the next time Celtic play, and now they've went and dropped points at the first opportunity after those points were made. Is that a worry? If you're going into deeper into the season, that they've already sort of lost their, could you say they've lost their nerve in this game? Or
no, I think it's too early to say they've lost their nerve. It's a basic case of them not being able to properly break down a very dogged and resolute defence. But you go back to, you look at someone like Gerrard, trying to win this game, why do you still have two defensive midfielders on the pitch? Why do you bring off Morelos and other strikers? Why do you just leave them on and have your three main strikers all on the pitch at once? Surely that offers you a better chance to score. At the time, I often find when Rangers are sort of searching for that goal, especially later on in the game, when they begin to get desperate, they begin to start shooting from distance, they begin to just be piling balls into the box. Surely in that case, that's when to get an extra man in the box, an extra man to hit, or potentially an extra man to run in behind, rather than having two sitting midfielders playing passes sideways, or playing them back to the centre-back and the goalkeeper. That just didn't make any sense to me. Why leave Jack and Kamara on? When you could bring on, or leave Morelos on and bring on Eaton, or even bring on someone like Greg Stewart, who could maybe pick out a pass to spot a defence.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a little bit baffling, to be honest, in a game where Livingston have been prepared to give up 79% possession of the ball. Why do you need to have two defensive midfielders on the pitch? I mean, I do agree on E10, just for a bit more of a physical target and focal point to the attack. But it's that sort of game. But there's no need to have those two central defensive midfielders in a game like this. It just seems like a bit of a blind spot, really.
Yeah, we did kind of mention that there was a bit of a bluntness in attack for Livingston. Big reason for that is that Lyndon Dykes looks like he's away. He looks as though that he's going to complete a £2 million move to QPR. It seems as though Livingston are more than happy to let him leave, not in the sense that they wanted him to go, but it's too good a deal to turn down, I guess. It's going to be a massive miss for Livingston, though. I'd maybe begin to worry where their main source of goals is going to come from after he leaves.
Yeah,
well, I think
it's a danger. Like we said, we just saw here. I think if Dykes is on here, Livingston do have a bit more going for them this game. I know they really didn't try and score at all, but you look at who comes on. You know, Livingston went with three strikers. Is it Popnik?
Yeah, Poplatnik,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, by all accounts. I mean, I missed the second half of this game, and I think he had to come off injured, but from what I'd been reading online, he seemed absolutely hopeless, which is a bit of a worry. And I've forgotten his name, the French guy that they signed from Queen's Park.
Kudir Asai, I think it is.
It's a big ask. I think we covered this in our sort of pre-season one. It's a big ask for a guy to step up from League Two to the top flight, and look at him now as possibly being your main striker to score goals. Hopefully for Livingston, they can maybe try and reinvest some of this, even a little bit of this sort of cash that they've got in a better forward.
Yeah, for me, obviously £2 million for Livingston is a great deal. Most clubs in Scotland would obviously accept a bid like that for a striker, even the calibre of Dykes will be disappointing. But for me, Livingston need to kind of follow their own lead and look for a similar type of deal to the one they got for Dykes in the first place. And like you said, Christy, I mean, they have money to play with, surely. You can just take a slice of that £2 million and probably find yourself a relatively similar profile of forward in the lower divisions of Scotland. There's not one that comes to mind name-wise off the top of my head, but I'm sure
I can't really think of anyone.
Yeah, I'm sure if they have a look, and they will constantly be looking, of course, but there will be someone who can fit the system, hopefully young, and hopefully they can kind of repeat the same sort of process, because it's the right sort of model for a club like Livingston.
But is the problem for Livingston now is obviously that we're all aware that they've got that kind of that £2 million in for Dykes. Is the issue now that might drive up the price for anybody they look to bring in to replace him? They know that they've got the money. If you want them, then you're gonna have to spend it.
Maybe, but then similarly, some of the clubs that they'll be looking to buy from will likewise need the cash, given the current circumstances and fans not coming in through the gates. So maybe, but also some of these clubs desperately need a cash injection. So it could work both ways, really.
Yeah, we'll kind of switch our focus now to the teams that didn't play. We'll just kind of touch briefly on them. Celtic and Aberdeen. Celtic are due to be playing tomorrow night. We are recording Monday night in the Champions League against Reykjavik. Without knowing anything about Reykjavik, I'd just expect Celtic to progress over the one-legged tie. But as you said before we came on, Christy, Celtic can be a wee bit jittery in the first legs of Champions League qualifiers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we spoke before we came on. I mean, Lincoln Red Imps comes to mind. I think there was one where they were in Kazakhstan that they had to come back from pretty well at Parkhead as well. So this should be a walk in the park for them, but I don't necessarily think we should maybe take it as that. They've shown before that they can struggle a little bit, and obviously we're looking at this as their first game for a couple of weeks. Obviously since the whole bowling goalie incident, so there might be a little bit of lack in that match sharpness, but we are speaking about the champions of Scotland here playing against the champions of Iceland, and they should really be coming through this with flying colours.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously you don't want to be disrespectful towards Icelandic football, but obviously the financial difference is vast. And I think in the sense that if they can come out and put together a decent performance, it will be good for match sharpness. But yeah, they just have to make sure that they do a professional job and get the job done.
Then to Aberdeen, the drama continues due to play on Thursday night against St Johnston. It looks like it should be going ahead. I think there's still new sort of rumours about the game on Sunday against Livingston, whether a sort of extended lockdown to the city of Aberdeen would see the city fit to host live football. But I guess we'll kind of wait and see what happens with that. It's all sort of rumours at the minute. But then, I mean, there's the rumour mill was running wild with Aberdeen today, claiming that Craig Bryce and Michael Devlin had been sacked. That's going that far. And I think one of the more solid rumours is that they're looking to sign Ross McCrory from Rangers.
Well, if you see that picture that I've just sent you, there is Ross McCrory holding an Aberdeen shirt at Cormac Park, so it looks like it's all been done.
All right, okay.
So that, you know, that looks, I mean, it would be pretty spectacular if it didn't happen now.
That would be total John Obi Mikel.
David Turnbull as well at Celtic. You know, yeah. There's that picture of him and Neil Lennon sitting in the trophy room, and he obviously didn't join. But I think we've had that discussion about this amongst us. It is a good signing for Aberdeen, but it's probably not the one that they really needed. You look at the Aberdeen team and you see that there at the moment there's a lack of a striker. There's a massive lack of a left back and a creative midfielder. And signing a player who's more of a holding player and can play as a right back or a centre back probably wasn't a priority. But I think you said earlier on is if Aberdeen weren't fairly well stocked, then that this would be a pretty good signing.
Yeah, I think I quite like it. I think if you were looking at it, it's like we'll say a young Scottish player. There's a good potential, and I think he. It's about over 100 appearances he actually made for Rangers in total, which you wouldn't really expect. I think during the 17-18 season he came in for a spell under Murty and he was really good. If he does perform to his potential, it could be a tasty sell on sort of value for him and Aberdeen. I quite like it. I don't expect though there's going to be some players leaving Aberdeen potentially over the coming week to sort of finance this, I guess, or free up some wages.
So just according to, if you're an Aberdeen fan, you've probably come across Haraldur Ignaholfsson AFC on Twitter. He's said it's a 4-year deal, but it's on loan for the first year. He won't be able to play against Rangers, which kind of seems a bit odd to me if he's going to be signing a permanent, but fair enough. And supposedly, you know, once he'd heard about the interest from Aberdeen, he was determined to come up here. Obviously, he was linked with Hibs, strongly linked with Hibs, and it just continues that sort of transfer window. Each transfer window, Aberdeen are just going to pinch a midfielder right from in front of Hibs, which get it up them.
Well, hopefully there's a wee bit more luck than Funtsu Ojo, so he's
yes, and Dylan McGeek.
Yeah, obviously one of the sole eight. But thoughts on that transfer, Haz?
Yeah, I think it's obviously just hearing the details about it being eventually a permanent deal. That was the only real concern I had about signing McCrory at all, was whether it was going to be an obligation to buy or, you know, obligatory permanent transfer. But yeah, I think that's a good profile of player to be bringing in. He's obviously a talented player. He's, by all accounts, was decent at Portsmouth last season, so hopefully he can make a positive impact at Aberdeen, where there's been so much doom and gloom. But yeah, like you have said, I think there's still gaping holes in the squad to address. But if the rumours are to be correct of players being sacked, then he could be important to fill those gaps.
Mm.
Yeah, for me, I'd rather he was actually played in a position rather than being used as the latest sort of Derek McInnes utility man of Dominic Ball and Zach Viner. I mean, he's a better player than both of them are, or were. But he has to find his position. Even at Rangers, he was regularly being moved between the centre midfielder, holding midfielder, and the centre half. This is a huge chance for him to find consistent first team football, and hopefully for him a consistent position to develop his career.
I think we'll shift. Well, I tweeted out earlier asking any questions, but we're kind of running long, so we'll just look at one, and it's from podcast alumni James E. Mack, or as he's known on Twitter, Jim Bett. He's asking, what will be the best approach to let fans back into grounds with regards to which leagues? How many fans, home and away fans, policing, social distancing, etc.? Well, by which leagues, I'm assuming he's meaning which Scottish leagues, so we'll just stick to them. Sprung this one on you just before we went on air. Have you come up with any solutions to Jamesy's question?
I'll give you one straight away. I don't think away fans will be in the stadiums this year. I think that's the first stage. I think the important thing, obviously, clubs will be looking at trying to get a lot of their season ticket holders, and with the exception of Rangers and Celtic, can probably do it without with distancing in place. Rangers and Celtic might need to be a case of every sort of second game. It's picked, and obviously that might not go down too well with certain games, such as obviously games against each other. So the easiest thing is there. It's probably also easier to do it within the lower leagues, where you've obviously got things like a lot of terracing. I'm just thinking to somewhere I go quite often in Gayfield, where I think it would be fairly easy. It's a large open terracing that goes around the ground. There's obviously you can mark spots and where you can stand and where you're not allowed to stand, certain groups and things like that. So it's probably easier to get fans in the lower leagues because of obviously the SA, because of the terracing, and it's easier to separate. Unfortunately, I think that we're a good bit off, and obviously it's been pushed back because of incidents involving the players at Aberdeen and Celtic, and obviously the sort of the local lockdowns and things like that. So unfortunately, we are a good bit away from getting supporters in. I know that they looked at getting them in as the trial for the playoff against Israel, and that's just not happening anymore, which is disappointing, but it's understandable. So I think we're probably, unfortunately, maybe even looking into the new year before we're allowed back in.
Yeah, I think, to be fair to James, he's asked a pretty difficult question because it's hard to draw an arbitrary kind of line as to, well, what percentage capacity can a ground be filled to. But, you know, there obviously it's essential that there is social distancing in the stands if fans are allowed back in some capacity. I was just wondering as to, I mean, I know there'd be a lot of grumbles if this were mandated, but what would your thoughts be if you had to wear a mask at a ground?
You're an idiot if you don't.
I think, I'd expect it to be a rule for whenever you eat. Doesn't matter how well, if you're going into the next year, I think there's still going to be masks. You'll have to wear a mask in the ground. I was just kind of thinking there was obviously the Israel game. If it seemed as though the country was at quite a decent level of cases and stuff like that before the Aberdeen spike, unless anything like that, nothing like that happens, potentially the Scottish Cup semi-finals would maybe be a possible date. That's, you're looking at, obviously, what, about 4 months away now. You'd like to think that the country can manage itself a wee bit until then. What was the Israel game? September, is that supposed
September,
to be?
September, so that was always penciled in as the date to trial it. I don't know whether or not they might move it back to the semi-finals as a penciled in date to try it. But even then, I look at that as being ambitious, and we've also got to remember that
travelling
next summer. Yeah, well, you also got to remember next summer that we've got games at Hampden for the Euros. And I don't know if they can go and try and postpone the Euros for another year, or if they just try and go and play it without crowds if the levels around Europe level off again. I really don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in public health or anything like that. I'm barely even an expert in football. So public health is not something that I'm too clued up on. I do sort of listen out to some other forms of media that talk about it, but to be honest, I can't really be bothered, you know, listening to an argument between Jason Leach and Ricky Foster, for example.
I'm just Jamesy's asked us a really difficult question here. Maybe one that could
I'd
be.
I'd like to get his answer for it.
What was that?
I'd like to get his answer.
Yeah,
Jamesy's answer would be free for all.
Yeah.
he's a bit more reasoned guy than that.
I don't want to
put him get him in hot water. So
we do know someone who'd probably want full capacity grounds, back by this weekend. But
by Thursday night.
I think any supporter that would go to that game is probably out their mind, because that could be a stinker. I think it's fair to say if I wasn't an Aberdeen supporter, wouldn't be tuning in out of sort of like my own choice for that game.
Well, there's a good chance that Sky are going to get 3-0 in a row.
Oh yeah. I mean, Derek providing the hat trick. That's exactly what he's after. Hey, St. McDermott Park's a difficult place to go. So, well, hopefully that goes ahead. Hopefully there's no more hiccups within the Aberdeen squad. Like they can't go out, so they'll have to go out to the shite Aberdeen Shire for a pint now, post St. Johnston game. But yeah, we'll round things off there. I don't think we'll bother doing a midweek one this week, just because
there's only one two, boss with Celtic as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, just because there's only two games. We'll leave that for now. We'll be back next week, looking back at the hopefully at a full match card for the first time since the opening weekend. But yeah, as always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.